Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo. On this episode, I interview Dr. Mike Simpson. Mike Simpson is a former Special Forces operator, airborne ranger, and battle-proven warrior with over 3 decades of military experience. Mike has made it his mission to save lives both on and off the battlefield. And welcome to the show, Mike Simpson.
Hey, thanks, Jason. I really appreciate you having me on.
Now, this is great. Hey, for the audience that doesn't know anything about you, which they slim to none, I'm sure a lot of people know who the legendary Dr. Mike Simpson is. Can you you've been in the military for decades now, right? Are you still in or are you out?
No, I finally hung up my spurs in November of 2016. I would have considered probably staying around a little bit longer, but kind of felt like it was time for the younger generation to kind of usher things in. And I'd done my part. I'd done my deployments. The wife, of course, had been through quite a few of them with me. My sons were kind of coming of an age where I wanted to be more readily available for them, obviously. So, I finally tapped out after 32 years and I was a quitter. turned in my stuff and left after 32 years, but enjoyed every single minute of it. I would not trade a moment of my military service for anything in the world.
Now, for the audience that doesn't know you, which, like I said before, has to be slim to none, you started out in the 80s as an Army Ranger, right?
I did. I 2 weeks out of high school in 1984. So I graduated in mid-June, and by the end of June, I still remember June 26th was my report date. I went through MEPS and reprocessed because I'd been on delayed entry for a year, and then got on a plane and flew to Fort Benning, Georgia, and started my military career in 1984. I was what they call a Reagan Ranger because, of course, the Ranger battalions at that time were still relatively new, stood up in the late 70s, and of course, Grenada was really the first battlefield test for the Ranger battalions, and then, but we were the quick reaction force of the executive branch. We were something that didn't need a declaration from Congress, didn't need permission of Congress. He could pick up a phone in the Oval Office and say, "Send a Ranger battalion here." Any spot. We used to say the whole world's a drop zone. So, spent half of my year at any given time on alert status that we could be anywhere around the world, wheels up in 12 hours, going to do terrible things to the enemies of our nation.
That's awesome.
That's kind of how I started. And then, had a little bit of, kind of finding myself in the late 80s. Wasn't sure if I wanted to be a civilian. Wasn't sure if I wanted to go into law enforcement, maybe do Secret Service, maybe do DEA or some other things. And then ultimately found my way back into the military full time. I never left part time. I was always in the National Guard. Went into 7th Special Forces Group, first as a demolition sergeant or engineer, as we're actually called, then as a Special Forces medical sergeant. Was in 7th Group for 11 years. Then went to medical school, went to residency as an emergency medicine physician, and then back to the special operations community, and ultimately did my time with JSOC, all my deployment time. And then, as I said, I retired as an emergency medicine staff, also at one time chief of the department up at Darnell at Fort Hood.
Wow. Talk about a career. Now, what was it like, transitioning from enlisted to officer? I know a lot of people are going to want to know what that's like. Now, were you SF enlisted and then you became an SF officer, right?
No. I was enlisted SF the whole time. My first 17 years, my first 17 years of my career were all enlisted, all as an operator in some capacity. And I really hated officers for the most part. So, the idea that I was going to be one was actually kind of bothered me a little bit. And I used to say if they would let me be a doctor as a master sergeant, I would be more than happy to do it.
I'm in the same boat. In the 90s, I was enlisted, yeah. And I went in the National Guard. And then one day when I got out of the Army, I was like, I don't want anything to do with it. And then one day I joined the National Guard, ROTC, and everything all in one day. And I'm like, oh man, what am I doing? I'm an officer, and I'm like, oh, okay.
there's two types of former enlisted who become officers, and I like to think that I'm in the latter category. The former category are those guys, you look at them and you go, yeah, if that guy got commissioned because he was never going to make E6 or E7.
Yeah, exactly.
and he just wanted to tell enlisted guys what to do. You see a number of those. And then there's a lot that have a clue. And I like to think I was in the category of the guys that had a clue and never forgot where I came from. And I always tried to maintain that. And I hope I did.
You can tell, like, I've been following you for a while now, and you can tell through your postings or your extracurricular activities outside of, you know, Spec Ops community that you actually, you know, you keep your feet well grounded. I just got to tell you that.
Well, I appreciate it, Jason. And you know, like I said, I try to never forget where I came from. I came from a working class family and humble beginnings. And I think that's really kept me in good stead, throughout my life. You know, I expect a hard day's work out of myself every day. And I expect the same from others around me, and, you know, to give respect and to get respect and say what I do and do what I say not have a hidden agenda and I try not to be self-promoting. You know, so some of that obviously on social media has to be self-promoting when you're trying to build a brand and everything else, right? I appreciate you saying that, because I've definitely tried to never forget where I started as a guy from a working class family who was a Ranger private, 90 millimeter recoilless rifle gunner, and I try to still be that person.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you're my fourth guest, which is, you know, I thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're the exact type of guests I'm looking for. Like, you know, that I believe the audience would love. Someone that has their feet grounded, that's really kind of what I consider a protector, someone who's given back to our country and continues to do it. You could tell it through all your extracurricular stuff. Now, before we get into that, tell me, where did you grow up?
So I was born in the South Bay. When people talk about California, you hear the Bay Area. So when they're talking about the Bay Area, they're talking about the San Francisco Bay Area. But then there's also the South Bay Area, and that's where I'm from. And that's Redondo Beach is where I was born. I lived there. I believe we moved out of there. I was 11 years old and moved out of the Los Angeles area, moved to a little town called Tehachapi, which is a little mountain town. You go through the high desert, go through Mojave and up into the mountains, and boom, all of a sudden there's a little town there called Tehachapi. And 500 kids in my high school, 122 in my graduating class. I graduated 102 out of 122, by the way. So was not a stellar student by any means in high school. Played football, hunting, fishing, you know, just a lot of time out in the wilderness. And I think a lot of what I became there in my formative years is what really forged me and what I would be in my military career.
Okay. Now, did you have like a lot of friends, like your dad's friends or anybody else that was in Vietnam? And is that kind of what pushed you towards the military?
Not really. So, my dad got out of the Navy in 1958. He was on the USS Bennington, which has long since been decommissioned and become a target ship floating somewhere. But my dad was actually in Vietnam in 1958, dropping off SEAL teams in the early days before most people even knew where Vietnam was on a map.
Wow.
But he never put feet physically in the nation of Vietnam. So my dad he's deceased now, but didn't consider himself a Vietnam vet, never described himself as one. None of my uncles were in Vietnam on either side of the family. Really not, big Navy family on my dad's side. Little bit of a mixture on my mom's side, but nobody who had ever, I think, done more than one enlistment. nobody who ever really came home and talked about it. Of course, I didn't know my grandfathers very well. So as far as their experience, I never really got to share that with them. Really for me, it was, the small circle of friends that I had growing up. One of which, was, my best friend growing up was a guy by the name of Brian Edwards. And Brian was a year ahead of me. And he and I used to talk about it all the time, about joining the military when we got out of high school and jumping out of airplanes and stuff like that. And we both ended up doing that. And even though he was a year ahead of me, we actually ended up in the same Ranger school class. He went to Special Forces right out of high school. I went to the Ranger Regiment. We were in the same Ranger school class. And then years later, after I made the walk and decided to go SF, he made some phone calls, vouched for me, got me a sit down interview with the sergeant major, and I ended up being in his company. We were on different teams, but in the same company in 7th Special Forces Group. And Brian ultimately went on to have an exceedingly successful Special Forces career. And ultimately, his last job was the sergeant major of Special Forces Command when he retired, which is pretty much the pinnacle for a Special Forces NCO. That's pretty much
yeah.
it. Brian, very highly placed and very well respected senior enlisted guy in the Special Forces community. I'm proud to count him as a friend and to know him. And Brian, of course, retired about a year after me, I think. I think he retired just last year in 2017. But yeah, that was pretty much it. It was, you know, just, it was kind of a generational thing for us. You know, Ronald Reagan was president. It was cool to be a patriot again. And there was a huge upsurge in the mid 80s in people not only volunteering for military service, but volunteering for those more difficult jobs, you know, volunteering to go into Special Forces, Rangers, SEALs. Of course, you know, SEALs weren't quite as popular then. The SEALs, you know, since the days of Dick Marchenko, have had a much bigger uptick in popularity because they've been popularized in movie and televisions and books and everything else. But
lots and lots of books.
Yeah, lots and lots of, you know, that's a joke is, you know, when you do you get your, you know, as you get, do you get your Trident and your book deal at the same time? How does that work? You know, there's a SF guys like to tease SEALs in how much they write books. But the truth of the matter is, I think they've done an excellent job. And I've said this to SEALs and I've said this to my fellow SF guys. There's probably a very small percentage of people out there that could go either way. Like we could recruit them or the SEALs could recruit them.
Well, you know, and you bring up a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. They go that way. You know, there's a lot more PR out there and a lot of guys in SF are like, well, we don't need it. We're the quiet professionals. Yeah. That, you know, that's true. I mean, it's not like we're hurting, but you know, but at the same time, there might be one or two really top notch guys out there that we're missing out on a chance. I can tell you there's, you know, of course I've been on television, as you know, and, I've had a few SF guys, basically tell me off to my face, for being on television, saying that's not something I should be doing. I shouldn't be going on TV and touting the fact that I was an SF guy and it's bad for the regiment and all this other stuff. And
yeah,
I say, well, if I put my college degree on my resume, then I should put my military credentials on my resume as well. So,
well, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s myself, the only thing we had out there was the long range recon patrol books. And you know, and that's it. You didn't know what was out there. I didn't know anything really about the Navy SEALs. You know, the Charlie Sheen movie is about it.
<You know? laughs> Yeah.
And then you always heard Delta and everything, but you never heard anything about SEALs. And now, you know, it's the same thing. Like, I love reading SF books. I love following a community. So there's nothing, I just wrote a book and there's nothing wrong with it. Why not? Everybody, the old adage is everybody has a book in them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why. And I'm writing a book too. It's not about, my adventures or exploits on deployment or anything like that. You know, it's not a book where I'm having to, talk about ODAs I was on, but change everybody's name. It's a book about how the military shaped me and ultimately shaped me for success and the lessons that I think that I learned in 32 years that I can share with people that maybe don't want to go in the military, but they can still find success. Utilizing the lessons that I had to pay for in a slightly different way. And And I hope it's a book, ultimately, when I get it published, I hope it's a book that people will get something out of.
Yeah, definitely. Do you have an expectation of when it's going to come out, or a title or anything? Or
I'm right about halfway through, but I've been kind of locked up. The chapter that I'm getting ready to write is a very, very key chapter that's going to be very important. And I've sat down and tried to launch into it 2 to 3 times. And I really want this one chapter to be perfect. So I've kind of abandoned it in draft form a couple of times. So that's kind of held me up. But I'm hoping to have it at least be shopping it to publishers by this summer, you know, possibly out as early as next year.
Awesome. Now that brings me to the next point. You have a lot of extracurricular stuff going on right now. And by extracurricular, I mean, you have some really cool things. Like you have the two podcasts. You have the Mind of the Warrior and Sheepdog Response. And which one is yours? Are you in both of them, or how does that work?
So they're actually the same podcast. So what happened was I started a podcast kind of on a lark. I believe it was in 2015. Just because there were so many people podcasting, I thought it was an interesting medium. And I said, you know, I've got some stuff I'd like to talk about. And really what kicked it the most was I would listen to podcasts. I would listen to podcast interviews, and I would think of the questions that I wanted them to ask that they weren't asking. And also I had, at the time I was writing for it's now gone, but there was an MMA website, that was crowdsourcing kind of subject matter expert bloggers. And I was writing for that at the time. And because of a couple of the articles that I wrote, I got, asked to be on one sports podcast and then on another kind of, personal development self-help podcast. And I enjoyed doing those so much. I said, I'm going to do my own. And I started Mind of the Warrior. Did that for a while, then took a long hiatus. When I went to work as medical director of Sheepdog Response, Tim and I transformed that podcast into what became the Sheepdog Project podcast. And we did that for a while. Of course, Tim got really busy, had his own show that he went off and did on television, deployments, work schedule, everything else. So Tim had to take a long break away from podcast, and it kind of ended up being me solo again. And then ultimately, I ended up giving up my job as medical director of Sheepdog Response. Still have a great relationship with the company. Still meet Tim for lunch all the time, and we text back and forth. But that just wasn't going to be – I wasn't going to be the right fit for the company and what they needed, and they weren't going to be the right fit for what I needed kind of going forward at this particular time. So when we decided to go separate ways, I said, hey, you know, it doesn't make sense for me to keep this podcast as a reflection of you guys, because it's really going to be me and my own opinions, and I don't want to say things that are going to get the company in trouble or that you guys would have to disagree with. So we all agreed it was best for me to go ahead and rebrand it back as Mind of the Warrior again. Okay. So that was kind of a long answer, but yeah, you can find me under the heading of two different podcasts, but they're really the same podcast. And if you look on YouTube or Podbay or anything else, they're all on the same feed.
Okay, good. So it's called Mind of the Warrior, right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And I've seen it. It's on, you know, for the audience out there, it's on iTunes. Check it out. It's awesome. I've listened to it. That brings me into the next thing. How do you go from, you know, SF podcasting to all of a sudden you're hunting Hitler?
Interesting turn of events there. Cause actually I was kind of counting down the last, five or so months till I was going to retire. I already knew when my retirement date was going to be. I had a ton of leave saved up. So I was going to take, like the maximum possible amount of terminal leave that you can take. And then it wasn't that I hadn't thought about doing TV before. In fact, I'm friends with Terry Shepard, and he and I had talked about doing a couple of projects, but hadn't really agreed on anything, or should I say hadn't really got anything sold. And then Tim, of course, who I'm friends with, put out something on his private Facebook page. He said, hey, look, I'm got a TV project coming up. And I knew he'd already done one season of Hunting Hitler. So I had a feeling that it had to do with that as a continuation of that. And he said, you know, we're looking for somebody with the following qualifications. And he gave this list, and I sent him a text and I said, hey man, I meet all your qualifications. What do you got going on? He said, shoot me an he said, email me a resume. And I did. And he sent it to the studio. Studio contacted me back, did a phone interview, did a Skype interview, went through a kind of a lengthy process, where certain people wanted me to do it. Certain people maybe wanted somebody else to do it. Long story, but to make it short, ultimately, I did get selected to go with the team as an investigator. And basically the plan originally was that I was going to be the Tim and I were going to be like counterparts to one another, him being on the South America team and me being on the European team. And that's, for the most part, that's how season two was broken down, until ultimately I ended up joining him in South America for the finale, which was really cool.
It was really cool. Yeah. If you haven't checked out Hunting Hitler yet, check it out. It's on, I think, is it on Hulu now too? Or no, I had it on Amazon.
I know it's on Amazon. I think it might be on Hulu. Also, if you have DirecTV or actually most cable providers, any cable provider that you have History Channel as part of your package, you can go to the History Channel's website and it lists all the episode. And all you have to do is it says enter, you click on who your provider is, and then you enter the phone number associated with your account with whatever that provider is, and it'll let you watch all the episodes on your laptop.
Okay, very cool. Now, one of the reasons I asked you on today is you have a lot of interaction with LEOs, obviously, you know, decades with military, and we're trying to make the show into like something inspirational. And one of the big things is like people like me, you know, you've been in an LEO for years, maybe been out of the field. Just trying to, what is something inspirational you could say to kind of get someone to get that fire back in? I know it's always like, hey, you know, you're either going to start working out or you're going to die. But is there anything in between workout and die that you can kind of push out there?
Yeah, there is something between that. And that's, you know, and what's between that is progress over perfection, you know, doing a little bit each day. You know, if, you know, maybe every day, I can't do a full hour and a half CrossFit workout in the morning and go to jiu-jitsu that night. Maybe I can't. But hey, what I can do is for 30 minutes, I can do burpees and air squats and push-ups and lunges and jumping lunges. Even if that's just for 30 minutes in a hotel room. And it's when it comes to exercise, better than nothing is better than nothing. A lot of things that we say are better than nothing aren't. But when it comes to exercise, I think it is. And the important thing that everybody needs to remember, you know, we used to say in Ranger Regiment, when you're on the plane in the middle of the night, rigged up, you know, you parachute on, rucksack hanging between your knees, camouflage face paint on, the door's coming open, and you're getting ready to jump into a place with real pop-up shoot back targets, that is not the time to think, I really should have PT'd a little bit harder last month. You know, I'm not in good shape right now. It's too late. And, you know, if you're doing a high risk stop and you ask somebody to get out of their vehicle and in the blink of an eye, it goes down, that's not the time to think, if only you'd have swung on me next week, because I'm planning on starting jiu-jitsu on Monday. I'm starting jiu-jitsu on Monday. You know, why couldn't you have picked a fight with me on Tuesday? You know, that's not the time to think that. So you really do. If you're out there walking that thin blue line, you got to take action. You can't, this is not a job you can just tread water. This is not a job you can just do the minimum and hope to get by, because this is the difference in whether or not you might make it home to see your family at night. And we live in one of the most dangerous times for law enforcement. The statistics might not back me up on that, but I think when you have groups out there like Antifa and Black Lives Matter and the sovereign citizens and the free travelers and the flat earthers and whatever these people want to call themselves, that are going into these interactions with law enforcement officers with a hidden agenda and a preconceived notion of how things are going to go down and a chip on their shoulder, I think it's potentially disastrous for LEOs. And God, I give anybody who's out there working that job right now, I give you ultimate credit each and every day. And, you know, nothing pisses me off more than people posting these videos on Facebook and saying, look, a police officer abusing his authority and whatever. It's like, you have no idea. He had no way of, you know, he walked up to that car who he'd already run the plates. The plates were expired. You know, whether or not the vehicle was stolen was in question. And all he knows is the driver has an object in his hand and is being obstinate. He doesn't know it's a cell phone. You know what? And it's, I would rather have an officer curse at 1,000 people and be rude to 1,000 people and go home alive in each one of those 1,000 encounters than I would rather have that than each and every officer bends over backwards and is way too trusting and has his guard down, and one out of 1,000 officers doesn't go home. And I think people just don't understand the difficulty of the job. They don't have enough respect for the job. And to me, a lack of respect for authority is a lack of respect for oneself. I think when you see people that don't respect authority, you're looking at somebody that has no self-respect as well.
Well, you're also looking in, you know, it used to be fight or flight with the suspect, and now it's fight or fight.
Yeah.
You know, and you're seeing it more and more that you have to have some sort of, and your backup just can't be another secondary device or another use of force weapon. The backup a lot of times is your own body. So if you're, I mean, you know, just as well as I do, if you spar in 2 to 3 minutes, you're smoked. Imagine that's a suspect or he's got a buddy and you're out there alone. So yeah, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And the reason I said Monday is everybody has that Monday in their head that, you know, I'll start Monday.
Yeah. That's not a can you can kick, man. It's just, you got to do it. You got to, a little bit of effort now, it pays huge dividends later. You know, and more sweat in training means less blood in combat. And you have to make yourself uncomfortable, be willing to be uncomfortable. That's not a job you can half step, man. If you want to half step a job, if you want to phone it in, go work in the garden section at Home Depot. But you don't be wearing a badge, man. That's not good for you. When I was still instructing for sheepdogging, we would talk about this all the time. It's the lion's share of people who you see who end up on video because what they're doing looks like excessive force, or they had to go to a tool, whether that was a taser or their pistol. It's because they weren't training. It's because they weren't in good physical shape. It's because they weren't on the mats doing whatever fighting discipline would help them be better in that situation. And consequently, they found themselves in the deep end of the pool. You want to see somebody who looks like they can't swim, put a weight belt on somebody and throw them in the deep end. And they might be somebody who knows how to swim, but all of a sudden it looks like they have no idea what they're doing. And if you're not in good physical shape and you don't know how to do what you need to do without those tools, you're going to instantly be flailing. And that guy in the deep end of the pool is going to instantly inflate his life-saving device. And somebody in that fight or flight situation is going to instantly go for one of those tools. And now you're on video shooting somebody or tasing somebody. And that might have been the right thing to do. But if you could have just got him to the ground, gone to mount, put him in the gift wrap position and held him there until help arrived, that doesn't even look bad on video.
No, not at all.
And everybody goes home. So now not only do you get to go home to your family, but you don't get suspended. You don't have an investigation. You don't have people doxing you and saying where you live and accusing you of being something you're not. I mean, for God's sake, we had, if you remember in Dallas, a police officer who died in the line of duty because he had a Thor's hammer tattoo. Some jackass was accusing him of being a white supremacist. Just ridiculous, you know, because as soon as you're in any type of public eye situation like that, you become an open book and people want to know who you are, where you are. People start crying for you to be doxxed, lose your job. people to do terrible things to you. And that's the world that we live in now. We live in the world of this internet mob that just wants to take anybody down that they don't agree with. And you can alleviate that. You know, just good cardiovascular shape, some good basic fighting skills. You don't have to use your tools. There's a very boring video of you, you know, mounting somebody and wrestling them that, you know, you never punched them once. Well, nobody's going to care about that video. When in reality, you know, you actually completely dominated that individual. You went home, they went to jail, everybody wins.
You know, just to echo on top of that is, you know, the quarterly range and defensive tactics isn't your time just to get your, you know, your shot in there of learning how to do defensive tactics. This has to be like an ongoing thing. It's like the repetition. Yeah.
Yeah. The quarterly, that needs to be that's not training. That's an assessment. That's a yardstick. That's to see where you are at different points in the year. If you're depending on that for your training, you are wrong. That's, you know, you need to be going to the range, you know, and I recognize the long hours that LEOs work and, get the tap rack, get some tap rack trainers and spend some time dry firing. So, you know, spend some time working reloads, working malfunctions, in your garage. If you can't get to the range often enough, you can be doing that because I can tell you this because it's been proven in the military, proven in law enforcement. All of the high level firearms instructors will tell you that that does directly translate and make you better. If you're dry firing, if you're using whatever it is, snap caps, tap rack trainer, whatever it might be, all of that directly translates. If you're doing a little bit of exercise each day and maybe you can only get to jujitsu one day a week because your schedule is so crappy. Well, hey, you know, stay in good cardiovascular shape the other days and go that one day a week. And that it is better than nothing. You know, I'd rather everybody go 2 to 3 days a week, you know, and I jujitsu, obviously I'm preferential toward, but it could be anything. And then when you are doing those, combatives assessments every quarter, you'll see a huge difference. You'll know the difference between people that go all the time, people that go once a week, and people that only do it once a quarter when they have to.
Well, the other thing I've learned too is if you just sit down, like right before you go to bed, is just visualize those techniques you've learned during the day.
Yeah.
It's crazy how much it actually helps.
Yeah, absolutely true. And, you know, it's, if you're sitting there, you know, if you're sitting behind a billboard somewhere with your radar gun on a night shift somewhere, you know, be picturing in your mind, you know, what your hand placement is like to do an arm drag, what your hand placement is like to do a collar tie, to do an underhook, what your feet place, you know, what's it going to feel like on the balls of your feet as you throw a right cross properly, as you lift your elbow to block as they're throwing a right to hit you in the left side of your head, you know. Remember what that feels like. And again, you know, you hit the nail on the head. The scientific studies are out there to show that those visualizations do work. They did a study. They took 100 people, and I believe they had one group do nothing. 25 did nothing, I think. 25 visualized shooting free throws. 25 really did shoot free throws for a certain amount of time every day. And I don't remember what the last group did. But the group that visualized shooting free throws and the group that actually shot free throws, when they got them at the end and tested them, actually did almost the same. They found out that just visualizing yourself doing that activity was almost as good as really practicing.
No, it's, I agree with absolutely everything you said. And, you know, now I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, I need to, just start now. And there is no Monday. Because, you know, just like, you know, I've been in an LEO for 19 years now, but I've been behind a desk for a bunch now. But you never know. You just really never know. It could be anywhere. As soon as you put on a gun and badge, it could be anywhere.
Well, and you have to, even for those guys who are working a desk job. So my next door neighbor is a high-ranking sergeant in the Austin PD. And so I'm getting home from work one day, and whether I was talking to him, and I'm looking at his kit, and I said, "Where's your tourniquet?" And he said, "Oh, I don't have one." He said, "You know, I'm in a supervisory role. I'm not," he said, "we have a limited number of them for the department. So, you know, the guys who are out there every day in the trenches, they're the ones that need them. So I don't carry one. And I'm like, well, that's completely unacceptable. So I walked over to my house and I got him a tourniquet. I said, here's your tourniquet. Cause you know, it never, he could be on his way home and sees a situation that he's, you know, for me, if I'm driving down the road and I see an LEO in a honest to goodness fish fight with a guy he pulled over, I'm not obligated to do anything. I can keep driving. I'm not going to. I'm going to pull over and help. But he's obligated. You're obligated. Even if you're working a desk job, you know, even if you're on physical rehab for an injury, you still have that obligation because of wearing that badge of what you have to do. And it could be in the supermarket too. You know, you see an altercation in the supermarket or you're walking to a gas station right as it's getting robbed. You've got an obligation there. So even if you're relegated to duties that don't have to do with doing this day to day, you still need to be ready for
it. I agree completely. And that's like, you know, where you have to have your everyday carry stuff. And the tourniquets are big. They're even making ankle holsters for tourniquets, which are incredible. And I'm almost positive you've seen the video out of Las Vegas where the guy had a, looked like an arterial bleed and the sheriff pulled out a tourniquet after, you know, this is after the sheriff shot him and cinched the guy up. Boom. Cause he had an ankle tourniquet.
Yep. Yeah. You gotta carry a tourniquet and you gotta know how to use it. And that's a big thing that I preach. And I've taught a trauma management course in Las Vegas. Who knows? Maybe that was one of my students.
You never could have been. Yeah, hey, so you've been talking a while now. Great career, great everything. Now you've been on the other side of the mic a bunch of times. Now, what would you ask yourself?
What would I
Something
ask
unique.
Myself? Something unique.
It's like an interview question. If you want the job, you got to tell me.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. Well, the big one. You know, you already asked me about the kind of the get off the couch question. I think a good question. I'm trying to think of the right way to word this. And I'm kind of paraphrasing a question that I've been asked before, but Mike, you've had this military career and done a lot of stuff with travel and everything else. You know, what do you say to the person out there that, is never went down that road? And maybe they're about your age and they've never picked up and started any of this stuff. You know, what do you say to them? I guess would probably be a good question for me to ask myself. And what I would say to them is, it's never too late. You know, I didn't start doing jiu-jitsu until I was 46. I started a lot of things late in life. I went to medical school at 36. I was an intern at 40. I've always, when it comes to peer groups, I'm always one of the oldest people in the room. And it's never too late. You got a lot more life in you and there's never a point in your life, never, ever, ever a point in your life where you should say, well, I've already made it this far. I'm already at this age and I haven't done any of that stuff. So I guess it's just never going to happen. Because I have a whole chapter in my book that deals with this. Is too many people I think are doing what I call living their plan B. Okay, they're not living plan A and ready to fall back on plan B. They're living plan B, which is not necessarily the life they envision for themselves at a younger age, but it's the one that pays the bills and it's the one that's comfortable. And everybody needs to have a plan B. You know, you need to have that fallback. Like for me, if they decided, Mike, you really are too ugly for television and you're a terrible interviewer, you're never podcasting again, and you're a terrible teacher, we don't want you teaching trauma courses anywhere. My plan B is I'll go back to doing medicine full time. Cause right now I don't work in the ER full time. I work in the ER, but not full time. So that's my plan B. I'm living my plan A, which is all the things that I like to do. And I think too many people live their plan B. So keep your plan B. Plan B always needs to be there, but figure out what your plan A was and try to live your plan A. You know, that your plan A might have been, you wanted to own a bar or you wanted to own a gun range or start a band or just be an author or, you know, write comic books, whatever your plan A was. You know, try to, even if your plan A, even if you're only spending 25% of your time on your plan A, try to make that plan A a reality, and you're going to get a lot more.
No, I love that. I mean, that's a great, you know, message to end it with. I mean, that's what I like about this interview and stuff, man. I'm learning so much. It's great. Just even for myself, it's great.
It's fun,
man.
Isn't it?
It really is. So yeah. Dr. Mike Simpson, and we have everybody check out Mind of the Warrior. Do you have anything else you're up to and you want to pitch out there?
I'm back on social media.
I saw that you were out for a while.
Facebook. I was out for a long while. Facebook.com/ Dr. Mike Simpson spelled all the way out. And I'm on Instagram at, Dr. Mike Simpson, DrMikeSimpson. I also have drmikesimpson.com going now, which, if you want to email me, there's a contact form right on there. Got a couple of maybe TV projects going on, you know, maybe they'll go. I've got three potentials, one of which would probably only be on the BBC. So you'd probably never see it in the United States. We'll see. If it happens, it happens. I've learned at this point that only about 5 out of every 100 ideas that get pitched ever get made in the TV world. So, it was fun doing it. And I'd like to, you know, I only want to work projects that I actually find interesting and that I would watch myself. So we'll see where that goes. And I'm going to keep podcasting, and I'm the medical director for Persis Medical, which is an amazing company that makes amazing pre-hospital products, and going to keep doing jiu-jitsu and married to an amazing wife with two amazing sons. And,
very
that's
cool.
My thing.
Well, I want to say thank you and look for the podcast soon.
All right, Jason. Thanks for having me on, brother. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all you do.